Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't
gamble.
I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, college football edition. A massive game on the docket come Saturday night. Of course, we'll spend plenty of time deep diving that. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only, Payne Insider.
Biggest game of the season so far. Bama, Georgia action. Looking forward to that.
Good to see a top three showdown, one that'll go a long, long way in defining the national championship picture even before the Big Ten and Pac-12 kick off their season. The SEC has been the gift that keeps on giving, and we can only hope from an entertainment value, Payne, that we get something similar from Alabama to what we had last Saturday night where they put on, I guess, loosely defined as a track meet against the Ole Miss Rebels out there in Oxford.
It wasn't loosely. That game should have had even more points in it. There was the early snap over the head of Matt Corral on like a third and one early in that game in the green zone, which forced a punt after it was thrown to midfield over his head. And then you had the fumble at the one from Najee Harris. So that should even had more points in the game.
Yeah, it was interesting when you look at some of the numbers after the contest. I think Alabama picked up about 93% of their available offensive yards in that contest. Punted once. And had one drive stopped on the 1 yard line when Najee Harris put the ball on the carpet, the only blemish on his resume after scoring 5 touchdowns. But I think we may as well get into that. When we look at the top 10, I know we've been discussing that in great detail to kick off each of these college football podcasts. Not a lot of changes there. You look at that latter portion, Penn State, Florida, Wisconsin, North Carolina, BYU, 6 through 10. And of course, if you're looking for the most overrated and underrated teams from the Bet the Board top 10, you can always check that out. And Outkick, as our article will be posted there later this week. Normally, Payne, our listeners know we go through rotation order, but I think a special game on tap deserves special placement atop the podcast. And that, of course, is the Alabama-Georgia showdown, where you're looking at Alabama, a 6.5-point favorite at FanDuel. Total on this game sits at 57.5. And when we try and set the stage for this particular contest, let's not sugarcoat it. Alabama has absolutely owned Georgia. Nick Saban has won 5 straight against the Bulldogs. When you look at this Georgia team, they've been dynamic away from home, going 8-1 straight up on the road, 6-3 against the number. And they've been lining people's wallets in the league, 13-7-1 against the spread. Of course, when you look at this particular game, you have the number one yards per play offense in the Alabama Crimson Tide, matched up against the number one yards per play defense in the Georgia Bulldogs. But I almost think, Payne, we should start on the other side of the ball and try and figure out how your boy, Stetson Bennett, will look to attack an Alabama defense that was rather vulnerable against Matt Corral and the Lane Kiffin-led Ole Miss Rebels last weekend.
I like that you went contrarian there, because everyone will talk Bama's offense against Georgia's defense, and obviously with good reason. We'll probably get to that in a minute here. But this is the side of the ball I think that has the most variance. You know, Todd Mungin's offense with a walk-on quarterback that you seem to hate.
Hold on a second here. Hate is a strong, strong word. I believe my text to you said untested, and I was a little bit leery of how he might perform on this big stage. Don't want to say hate. I wish I liked the guy more had he thrown an interception or two last week against Tennessee, but that's now water under the bridge.
Yes. Now, I guess the follow-up question there would be like, what's the other option that's better?
Jamie Newman?
Maybe. I don't believe that, but we'll see. Getting back on track. I think this is the side of the ball that has the most variance, because we're not quite sure, to your point, what Stetson Bennett is. And then you have this Nick Saban defense that looks like a shell of itself. And at this point, to me, Stetson Bennett is a good point guard, so to speak, And so this is a step up in class, obviously, in terms of the program he's going against. I think we also want to see if this is a different Alabama defense after being embarrassed by Ole Miss. Having Nick Saban, you know, probably chew your ass out all week. Those are things that we're going to have to look for here. Those are the big questions that we don't have concrete answers to that we'll try to, I think, dig into some of these matchups that will go a long way in deciding things this weekend, Todd.
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about some of those question marks, and obviously Alabama trying to figure out its identity on the defensive side of the ball. We knew coming into this year that the secondary was pretty inexperienced, other than Patrick Surtain, who looks to be the next guy in the long list of Alabama players that'll be high-round draft picks in the National Football League. Talent was there, but they were short on experience. Linebacking position, we knew that a couple guys returned. I don't think that's been the real problem. But Payne, you and I both watched that Ole Miss game, and there was blown coverage after blown coverage. It's simply amazing that Alabama couldn't figure out, hey, look, we're going to try and throw the ball to Patrick Yeboah if you're Ole Miss, and Alabama, we're going to dare you to stop him. They had absolutely no answers.
No, and I think if you're looking at when Georgia's passing the ball here, to me, and again, I know we differ a little bit here, I think Stetson Bennett has been the lifeline to the offense. And, you know, he's not going to intimidate anyone, and I think that's why the perception of him is we don't quite believe yet, because you know, he doesn't have the size or the stature or the arm strength. But I don't know if Georgia needs that. They just need this point guard, right? A quarterback that knows where the ball needs to go. He can get it out on time. He can deliver it accurately and avoid the mistakes. That's it. And that's what Stetson Bennett has done so far. The interesting part about this, when Georgia does throw it, it seems like where Stetson Bennett is most comfortable kind of distributing the ball and getting it out is where Alabama's been vulnerable. So you want to attack the middle of that defense, as we saw last week, if you're Georgia. And I dug into this a little bit. Stetson Bennett right now, 16 for 21 on throws at or between the hashes. Two of the five incompletions have been drops. Stetson Bennett right now averaging 14.3 yards per pass attempt on these throws over the middle to all sectors, short, intermediate, deep. When you look at Alabama's linebackers and safeties, that's where it's been struggle city defending the middle of the field. You look at Christian Harris giving up over 2 yards per route run in a 155 passer rating coverage. Dylan Moses has been maybe just a touch better. He's allowing a 120 passer rating. Safety Jordan Battle allowing a 118 passer rating. He's also suspended for the first half of this game for targeting. When you look last week, something that we're probably not accustomed to from a Nick Saban defense is their explosive play percentage allowed. That was over 16%. And it's mostly because Bama's third down defense hasn't been, I would say, up to Nick Saban's and Alabama's defensive standard. If you actually look, Ole Miss average distance to go on third down last week was 8.4 yards, but Bama allowed a 53% success rate on third down. Matt Corral completed 82% of his throws on 10 or more yards. And I think that's probably the big down to watch here, because Georgia's been successful on 49% of their third down throws. That number significantly better when you parse out and use only the Stetson Bennett sample. The other thing worth mentioning is, you know, what really gave Alabama some trouble defensively was Ole Miss's tempo. That gave Bama fits. And right now, Bama doesn't have a deep defense to me, right? With the way Clemson's recruiting, the way Georgia's now recruiting with Kirby Smart, a lot of these kids from that area are not all going to Alabama. So the depth isn't quite there. And the thing we've seen with Stetson Bennett, when he's in, Georgia's playing a little bit faster. And you can tell on some drives, the Bulldogs go out there and they have this, you know, deliberate plan that this specific drive, we're going to, you know, operate at a breakneck speed. I think it probably is a good idea if you're Todd Monk and you're Georgia to employ that strategy a few more drives this week, make Alabama work. You know, those are the kind of the key things here. Occasionally, you know, a deep shot is fine, but I think you're looking for down to down consistency if you're Georgia's offense here. Alabama really hasn't shown an ability to get off the field.
You know, it's interesting when you look at this Georgia team, we know so much of what they want to do is predicated on the ground attack, and they've lacked a little bit of that explosive big play potential. Zamir White, of course, has been their leading back. He's toted the rock 54 times, but averaging less than 4 yards per carry. They played last week without James Cook dealing with a bit of a shoulder injury. We did see Kendall Milton get more involved, and I think he becomes the X factor on the ground. He's got a little bit more of that home run potential and that explosive burst that you'd like to see. Kenny McIntosh also, I'm sure, will factor into the mix. But as far as Georgia's receivers are concerned, Payne, Kyrus Jackson has really distanced himself as the most reliable guy, 19 catches, 300 yards this season. We saw George Pickens. We know what he's capable of doing when he's not acting like a knucklehead on the sidelines, taking his water bottle, shooting it on opposing quarterbacks. And then Jermaine Burton. He's the speedster that I think there has to have a package or two defined for him. As you sit over there giggling like a little schoolgirl, I'm not quite sure what your take is on Pickens acting like a moron on the sidelines.
We texted about this, you know, and all of the targeting calls that are now being instituted at, you know, all levels of football, but specifically college, where you're just like tossing these kids in the biggest game for things that happen within the realm of play. And you got this guy like squirting people with water bottle. Like, to me, that's more of an ejectable offense than something in the run of play. So that was like just crazy to see happen, but it was kind of funny. Jackson, you mentioned, he's actually graded out the best receiver in the SEC. Pickens, I think there's still some meat on the bone there. But when you look at these two teams, and you look at the two head coaches, physicality is going to be what is preached all week, winning that point of attack. And when you're looking at Georgia's ground game and you're looking at Alabama's defensive front, we haven't seen that dominant Bama defense that mauls teams in the trenches. Alabama has actually been pushed around at times, 32nd in adjusted line yards defensively. Alabama hasn't played behind the line of scrimmage at the rate that we are typically accustomed to. They've only stuffed 21% of runs at or behind the line of scrimmage. That's outside the top 30 in college football. Only 76 teams have played so far. So that is just shocking for a Nick Saban Alabama defense. Last week, Ole Miss did a very good job, you know, through some window dressing and misdirection and motion to have a balanced offense. When you remove sack yardage, Bama's defense gave up 5.3 yards a carry to Ole Miss. Running backs averaged 2.8 yards before first contact. So that's not your typical Nick Saban defense. You know Georgia's offense is going to try to at least get the ground game going a little bit. James Cook is expected back. He's practiced the last 2 days, so he's cleared for this game. So you're going to have the full complement of running backs here. But you think about this, that big Georgia O-line right now, 17th in adjusted yards, line yards. So they're moving guys around in the trenches, but the running backs have been subpar. So the ground game, I think, can be a little bit better if these running backs kind of reach their potential. Because right now, Georgia's 46th in the country in rushing EPA. The Bulldogs are actually earning negative points offensively every time they hand the ball off this season. So to me, the offensive line is going to do their job. The running backs need to be a little bit better. You mentioned Milton. Maybe he gets implemented a little bit more this week. But the one area where Bama's defense has struggled is stopping inside zone and inside power runs, whether it's naturally or with a read option element. Bama giving up 4.9 yards a carry on those types of runs. Georgia likes the inside zone, so maybe that's an area when you're looking at the ground game, if Georgia can get it going, if those inside zone runs seem to be working, it's probably going to be a lot easier to move the ball and help Stetson Bennett out, you know, substantially.
And Stetson's legs, we trust. We know he was able to extend a couple of drives last week against Tennessee. The mobility, I think, can take him a long way as things start to break down in the pocket, whether it's in that RPO plan, like you mentioned, or pure dropbacks. Obviously, Payne, we know that that side of the ball, as you mentioned, has a lot more variance, and the big football fans out there aren't going to focus there. They're going to look on the other side of the ball where we have two heavyweights doing battle, and that, of course, being the Alabama offense led by a number of NFL caliber wide receivers against a Georgia defense that we've seen on full display. You look at Mac Jones through six starts, completion percentage north of 77%, a yards per attempt well north of 12 yards pop, and 219 passer efficiency rating. He leads the FBS so far this year in efficiency and yards per attempt. Pretty impressive there. Of course, when you have three NFL wide receivers in Jalen Waddle, Devontae Smith, and an emerging John Michi, it makes life a little bit easier. Meanwhile, Georgia defensively, I don't think there are enough superlatives that we could heap on their shoulders for how good they've been, not only metrically so far this season, but what some of the expectations were coming into this year. And if Georgia has one deficiency, it's probably defensive line, but their linebackers and secondary clean it all up. Who, in your opinion, has an edge that they can exploit when we talk about Alabama's high-powered offense matched up against Georgia's tenacious defense?
I'm not really sure. That's the most difficult thing, because you're looking at these two units, and it's why everyone's going to talk about this side of the matchup, because you have the most efficient offense going against the most efficient defense in college football. And, you know, you're looking at Bama's offense, and you mentioned this at the top. They gained 95% of available yards and averaged more than 11 yards per play last week. Georgia's defense last week, unfortunate for us, in the second half, held Tennessee to 2.4 yards per play, an 18% success rate, and turned the Vols over three times as well. So this is likely the best matchup on paper that we're going to see all season between two units going head-to-head. I think this is tough for Steve Sarkisian because you don't really want to change what you're doing when you have an Alabama offense that's number one in basically every category, right? Number one in overall success rate, number one in early down EPA, number one in third down success rate, number one in third down EPA. Everything Sark is doing and Mac Jones, as you kind of alluded to there, is operating, has been lights out. We know Georgia's defense a little bit different. If you're Sark, I think you throw on Georgia's film defensively, and you have to be thinking that you might want to break some tendency. That will be important, throwing more on early downs, understanding that Mac Jones can probably handle more being put on his plate. Right now, Alabama is averaging nearly two-thirds of a point every time Mac Jones throws it. It's number one in the country. So I think, you know, at minimum, after seeing Garantano and Palmer connect on a few deep shots, Sark has to have Mac Jones test that because, you know, at the very least, if Alabama can hit one or two of those deep shots early, it's going to change the way Georgia defends you. You know, it may help open up the ground game or the shorter passing game if you can hit that deep ball. And listen, make no mistake about this right now. If you're looking at Mac Jones, he's been fantastic everywhere, but the deep ball rating is ridiculous. 151 rating, 69% adjusted completion percentage on deep balls. Mac has attempted 13 passes of 20 or more yards downfield. Those have gone for 443 yards and four touchdowns. So you do want to test that Georgia defense outside with your NFL receivers. And if you can hit a few early, it's going to be so important. It's going to change the way Kirby can defend you. Bottom line, there isn't this like simple recipe for beating Kirby Smart's defense while he's bad at Georgia. And if you look, teams since 2017 to beat Georgia and really kind of dispose of that defense in truly meaningful games have one thing in common. It's an NFL quarterback. That's basically it. Because the only teams that have beaten Georgia in games that actually matter since 2017 were Joe Burrow, Tua, and Stidham. This is probably, you could argue, Kirby Smart's best defense at Georgia. It's going to take Alabama's offensive line, I think, to create some room in the ground game. So you got to be a little balanced here. So far, they've done a decent job pushing some teams around in the trenches. Georgia, obviously, a little bit different. Top eight in adjusted line yards offensively for Bama. If you look at all the categories, adjusted line yards, stuff rate allowed, power success rate, sack rate, Bama's offensive line has been fantastic. They're going to have to be really good again here. And then it's going to take Mac Jones, I think, to be aggressive and accurate. You're not going to dink and dunk on Georgia. You know, you're going to have to actually challenge Georgia's defense. You have to punch the bully back, so to speak, here. And I think you want to let Mac Jones attack, force Georgia to play on their heels, and that's going to be the way here. But this is going to be a significantly different test, right? Like, they are going way up in class after having played an Ole Miss defense, and now you're seeing Georgia. It might be a little bit of a shock to the system early on when they adjust to the game speed.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at this Georgia team, I mean, they're massive on the defensive front. They run a nine-player rotation that pretty much all averages 300 pounds per man, plus a linebacking core that brings in guys that are NFL-caliber talents who run 4.5, 4.6, and all go about 240 strong. And you look at some of the numbers that Georgia hasn't given up this year, they've allowed just four runs of 10 yards or more all season, fewest of any team that has actually played three games thus far. Zero runs of 20 yards or more, and the linebackers have created 10 sacks. We know about Tennessee hitting a couple big plays in man-to-man coverage, and you think Georgia has to respect Alabama's receivers a little bit more. But Jaren Guarantano, for as poorly as he played in the second half, I mean, he basically had to drop the ball perfectly into a bucket to Josh Palmer on both of those touchdown passes.
Yeah, and we were texting back and forth. I was like, man, Jaren Guarantano figured this thing out. He's been pretty accurate.
He did for a half.
Yeah, he was accurate with the ball. He got it out on time. He wasn't making mistakes. And then things just completely changed at half, which was shocking because Tennessee got the momentum stop before halftime. You figure, hey, we're sitting here pretty here, taking a double digit dog leading at halftime, and they have all the momentum of the stop, and it just didn't happen. Now, Palmer, I thought, beat the DBs pretty clean on both the explosives. And listen, I'm not taking anything away from Palmer, but Bama's got better. You absolutely at least need to test it the way your receivers are playing, the way Mac Jones is playing. All it takes is hitting one or two. No harm, no foul if they don't connect. But if you connect, it's going to change the way Georgia has to defend you, and it's probably going to open up the ground game just a little bit more. The one thing that we've kind of talked about with that Georgia defensive line was, you know, they weren't creating negative plays as much as we thought they should. But right now, they've been pretty stout, right? You know, seventh in the country in adjusted line yards. So it's going to be a battle up front. It's going to be about who wins the physicality matchup to see who get the ground game going. But this is as good as a matchup as it gets. There's just right now, when you look at this matchup on paper, when you look at it X and O's wise, it's good versus good. You're not really sure where the massive advantage is going to come from here, whether you're looking at the Excel sheet or you're actually just watching some of the film. Again, it's going to take elite quarterback play. I think you want to attack this Georgia defense, and I think Mac Jones is probably up to the test. The line is really interesting here. Because to me, the line says Alabama's the play. We have seen a little early Alabama money come in when you could lay 4.5 or 5. We're now up to 6.5. It'll be interesting, Todd, to see if the sentiment changes if you can grab 7 with Georgia here.
You know, I'm trying to think through, and again, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, and I apologize since I don't have the line history in front of me. What the line move looked like when Alabama played host to LSU in the biggest game in the SEC West last year. I feel it was in this price range. Did we see money on LSU actually come in throughout the week, or was Alabama the side of professionals getting bet up when they hosted Joe Burrow?
Man, I'm not quite sure on that. I can't remember.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that you try and figure out how the market perceives a particular team versus the actual X's and O's that are out there on the football field. And of course, with such a limited sample size for both of these teams so far, knowing the overall impact it's going to have, regardless of who comes out of Tuscaloosa with a victory, they'll, of course, have an inside track to getting into the college football playoff and ultimately the SEC title game. But the reality of it is these are two teams that don't play every year because they're on opposite sides of the division. And even if you go out there and lose the game, whether you're Alabama, whether you're Georgia, by 3, 7, 10 points and look good in the process, I think it can actually have an positive net effect in terms of bolstering the overall resume, since these are clearly two of the best teams in the country that we've had power rated as such and believe outside of the Ohio States and Clemson are very much inside that top 5.
Yeah, it's really a top 4 at this point. And then there's this dramatic drop off. So it'll be interesting to see how the playoff committee decides to choose their participants this year, especially if a couple games get canceled. How are we going to handle the Pac-12 and the Big Ten, if they're only playing 5 or 6 games? That's going to be interesting. It'll be tough on the committee. But in terms of an actual power rating, it's really a big top 3. Georgia right there hovering around at 4. And then there's just this precipitous drop from Team 5 on down.
Should be one hell of a game Saturday night, and it's a good thing the Clash of the Titans will take center stage, of course. 8 o'clock Eastern on CBS. To watch this matchup. A game that I know you and I were both very excited for, Payne, that we're not quite sure we're going to get a chance to see on Saturday. So as we preview it, it will, of course, come with a caveat that should the game be played, we know the situation is fluid down in Gainesville as Florida will welcome in the LSU Tigers. Before this number was pulled off the board at FanDuel, you saw some money come in on LSU, obviously amid all the expectations that Florida could be down a few key cogs dealing with COVID-related injuries or illness, however we want to position it. Florida was as much as a 13.5-point favorite at FanDuel, total is 73. As we said, it came off the board, Florida 11.5 or so, and the total had ticked down a touch. Neither one of these teams played defense last week, or for that matter, really played defense all season long. LSU has allowed 96 points through their first 3 games. Florida, on the other hand, somehow is actually worse, allowing 100 points through 3 games. Only 4 teams in the country are actually allowing more than Florida's 495 yards per game. And you look at these two teams, both of them struggling to establish ground and pound attacks, putting even more pressure on their defense, and LSU in the unenviable spot in the SEC landscape of playing what would amount to their third straight road game after last weekend they were forced to abandon the friendly confines of Baton Rouge to take things on the road to Columbia, where they came up 1 yard short as 14-point favorites against the Tigers. I guess the bigger question, Payne, rather than looking at some of the matchups that we could see in this game, you know, what do we know about the Florida Gators at this point in the season? Other than Kyle Trask to Kyle Pitts, there seem to be a lot more questions than answers that Dan Mullen's dealing with, least of which his desire to pack 90,000 fans into the swamp before Florida had to shut down football operations with the COVID positive test.
So you're spot on with this line. There was some take at 14 from a couple professionals. It had to do with these cases that were potentially popping up for Florida. We're obviously discussing this game simply because of the magnitude. If it is on, then you guys will be well equipped to figure out what you want to do with it. In terms of Florida, I mean, we knew coming into the season that this was going to be a team that was led by its offense. Plain and simple. They lost too many guys on defense. The two key guys that they had coming back hadn't quite, no one knew where they were. Now we saw Stewart back into the game last week, so I think that should help things. But defensively, Florida is struggling right now. They're going to go as the offense goes. That's really what Florida's bread and butter is. And, you know, when I look at this, if they are to play, I think the Gators do what they want to do offensively. That's not going to be a surprise to anyone when you're looking at a total that was as high as 73. We heard earlier this week, Ed Orgeron effectively called out his defensive coordinator, Bo Blaney, and said in his presser, we've got to coach better on defense. This is the second time we've given up so many yards and so many points. It's just not LSU's defense. So he knows what he's up against this week. I agree with Ed. The problem is Ed made the horrific hire of Bo Pelini. So if this game does happen, we'll have to monitor a couple other things. Partly why this line came down a touch is Kyle Pitts is dealing with a left foot injury. So if the game is on, we'll have to monitor that. But basically, you know, we have a pass first offense with Dan Mullen and Kyle Trask going against an LSU defense that's struggling mightily to stop the forward pass. And I don't think if this game is played, that's going to change this week. And if you look in that opener, week one, Mississippi State, LSU's defense allowed a 63% passing success rate against a miserable Vanderbilt offense. LSU allowed 50% of passes to grade successful. And last week against Missouri, 58% of passes graded successful against LSU's defense. And on the season, if you look, LSU's defense has given up gashers as well. 15% of plays have graded explosive against LSU's defense. This just is not a very good matchup on this side of the ball for the Tigers. And what's really scary about this Florida offense, Todd, right now, their average distance to go on third down is one of the very worst in the country. Yet Florida's the second best third down offense in terms of EPA. Nearly 1 point every time has been expected when Florida snaps it on offense on third down. That's something to watch for if the game is played. Obviously, that's a big caveat. But there's actually potentially meat on the bone left here for Florida's offense, if you can believe it.
Well, what's interesting about Florida, you talked about Kyle Pitts and definitely have to keep tabs as he wasn't 100% late in that game against Texas A&M. They're getting Kadarius Toney involved as well, and we're finally seeing some of the big play potential he brings to the table. When you look at the speed he can show when he's out on the edge, he leads the team with 18 receptions, and that's a credit to Dan Mullen, knowing that, hey, look, the ground game with Pierce and Davis have shared the workload but have only accounted for one touchdown. You have to try and scheme up ways to get your playmakers open. And when you look at Florida so far this season, they've only run the ball 42% of the time on their offensive snaps, which probably should work against LSU that you know, hasn't been able to stop anything through the air, even with an NFL-caliber cornerback in Derek Stingley, who, keep in mind, also Payne, a little bit nicked up. Apparently, he slipped on the down marker at some point against Missouri. Haven't been able to get a firm assessment of what his injury status will be, but clearly not exactly a guy that you want to be without or one that's limited, given some of the struggles. But for all that's gone wrong for LSU defensively this season, everything seems to be trending in the right direction, at least on the offensive side right now. Goal line stand against Missouri notwithstanding, LSU we know needs to be better on third downs as they're last in the league, converting at 23%, and didn't convert a single one against Missouri, yet still found a way to score north of 40 points. Miles Brennan looking more and more comfortable leading this offense. He did probably take a few too many hits, but when you have a receiver as talented as Terrace Marshall, it makes life a hell of a lot easier throwing the ball downfield.
I had to do a double take. 22 catches last week. Just absolutely ridiculous. Another LSU receiver. And everyone thought he was just the possession guy, but he showed some speed and his draft stock is just rapidly rising. So far, through three games, I'm actually impressed with LSU's offense. And you look at Steve Ensminger, what he's doing offensively has been pretty electric for the most part. And when you kind of lose a helper that is highly sophisticated in Joe Brady, and you lose a quarterback like Joe Burrow, and weapons like, you know, Clyde Edwards-Helaire, Justin Jefferson, and Ja'Marr Chase, you would think that the offense is going to like completely fall off a cliff, but it hasn't. So he's doing something right. Now, the way Miles Brennan's playing, I think you want to increase the pass rate, especially on early downs. That's probably the only complaint I have about this LSU offense. And if you've looked, LSU right now only passing on 55% of first downs. On 59 first down passes, Miles Brennan has achieved the first down 24 times. So first down passes have bypassed both second and third down 41% of the time, just a ridiculous rate. LSU has also had gains of 15 or more yards on first down passes 15 times, 9 plays of 25 or more on first down passes as well. When LSU decides to be predictable and run it on first down, Tigers have achieved the first down on just 14% of their first down runs. 48 first down rushes right now have only achieved one play of 25 or more yards. So I think the way Miles Brennan's playing, the way Marshall is playing, those two guys are pretty in unison right now. You want to tick up the offensive pass rate, especially on early downs. And I think when you're facing a Gators defense that's struggling right now a little bit, that's the way to attack them as well. You're going to have to win a shootout if this game goes on. The other thing that we're seeing from Georgia's defense, or the Gators defense rather, is all the talk this week about a lot of changes coming both stylistically and personnel wise. Dan Mullen has been pretty emphatic about that early on this week, that change is coming. Not quite sure what that means, but when you have a Gators defense right now, it's allowed 500 yards 7 times in the last decade, and 2 of them have come this season. You're going to need to see some wholesale changes here. So whether it's Grantham playing a little bit more aggressively, like he sent blitzes last week. They didn't sack Kellen Mond one time, but some of the blitzes that they sent were like corner blitzes. They weren't very disguised from the linebackers. Everything just needs to be better defensively for the Gators, whether it's the plan of attack, whether it's the personnel. This is the one side of the ball that we've kind of talked about, right? As great of a coach as Dan Mullen is, the recruiting obviously isn't there to like an Urban Meyer level. And we're kind of seeing that on the defensive side of the ball right now. There's just not as much talent as we've grown accustomed to for a Georgia defense. By the way, Todd, as we talk, some of the 6.5s removing from the market on Alabama, Georgia.
Go figure. I think we're going to have a very different school of thought on those two particular sides in that game. Be interesting to ultimately see where that market settles. You get closer to the Saturday evening kickoff. Of course, Florida, LSU, let's hope we see the game. Obviously, at time of recording, we're not quite sure what the status of that contest will be as the number pulled off the board. Staying within the SEC, Payne, two rivals will renew acquaintances in the SEC East, where Tennessee will host the Kentucky Wildcats. And when you look at FanDuel's number here, significantly shorter than the market on this particular game, with Kentucky only a 4.5-point underdog, more or less the consensus out there, 6 everywhere else. Total on this game sits at 45.5. Series history, well, it's been pretty one-sided. Tennessee has won 33 of the last 35 meetings between these two programs. They've now won 17 straight at Neyland Stadium. Last year, the Vols were able to go into Kroger Field, rally from a 13-3 halftime deficit to win the game 17-13, ultimately turning Kentucky away with a goal-to-go situation as Lynn Bowden wasn't able to get into the end zone. You do have a level of familiarity, a lot of coaching ties here, as a number of the guys on Jeremy Pruitt's staff at Tennessee all work for Mark Stoops in various capacities in Lexington at some point. We look at scheduling overall, and it does play a role in some of the handicap. You wonder about Tennessee being able to get up off the deck after that Georgia loss. They have Alabama looming as their next game. Meanwhile, Kentucky, hey, they're fresh off a 24-2 victory against Mississippi State. But Payne, I think a lot of people, if they were scoreboard watching, didn't realize how ugly Kentucky's performance truly was in that game.
It's been ugly for most of the season, really. If you're looking at this Wildcat offense, they're struggling, and I think that's putting it mildly. 5.2 yards per play and a 39% success rate on the entire season. I mean, Auburn's defense is decent, but Kentucky's played the two Mississippi schools back-to-back, so the strength of schedule isn't anything that's been overly daunting, right? And you look last week specifically to your point, Todd, Kentucky averaged 2.9 yards per play and had a 28% success rate, somehow won that game by three scores. When I watch Kentucky, when I dig into some of the metrics, it's pretty simple. Terry Wilson needs to be a better passer to help remove some of the pressure from the ground game. And it's shocking to me that without this pass attack for Kentucky, they're still number one in the SEC, averaging 5.7 yards per rush. But imagine if every defense wasn't able to like cheat into the box to stop the run. We know the run game is Kentucky's strength, obviously, with that experienced offensive line. But when you look at Terry Wilson right now, maybe he's not 100% yet. You know, he missed some time with that knee injury, but he hasn't shown the ability to beat anyone consistently with his arm. Right now, a 36% passing success rate. 48% of Terry Wilson's passes this season have been graded inaccurate. And, you know, it's not like Wilson's being put in these unfavorable situations. Average third down distance for Kentucky, 6.2 yards to go. So they've actually been in a good spot there when, you know, you have an ability to potentially extend drives and pick up third downs. It's not like Terry Wilson's playing in third and a mile situations. I think the key to this game is seeing if Terry Wilson can convert the third and the medium through the air when he's, you know, tasked with it. Tennessee hasn't been good on third downs, 56th in the country in third down EPA because they've given up some chunk and explosive plays through the air. But you think about this, after a physical Georgia game where the Vols defense was on the field for 37 minutes, faced nearly 80 snaps, if Kentucky can convert third downs and keep Tennessee on the field and wear the Vols defense down, I think the Wildcats have a chance to stay within this number. And then obviously you got the big Alabama game on deck looming, Todd.
Yeah, and it's one of those things you try and figure out. Do you wipe the bad taste out of your mouth immediately and get ready to go? But I think Tennessee really had higher expectations for their performance against Georgia, and rightfully so. They were riding an 8-game winning streak going into that contest, took a 4-point lead into the break, and completely cratered in the second half. Do you get excited about the prospects of playing a Kentucky team that you've really dominated, you know, over the last 35 years? On the other side of the ball, Payne, coming into this year, we knew that Kentucky's defensive line was going to be their strength, and that's really shown up in their ability to defend the run. They held Mississippi State in check, 21 yards. That, of course, is a Mike Leach offense, so it's all relative. But when you look at Ole Miss and know what the Rebels were able to do against Alabama, holding them to 139 yards, albeit in a 1-point overtime loss, not the most damaging statistic, and they kept Auburn from eclipsing the 100-yard mark. So much of what Tennessee wants to do is completely predicated on, you know, Gray and Chandler getting going. 36 yards, though, on 16 carries, averaging 2 yards per carry versus Georgia last week. Didn't allow the Vols to keep drives sustained as they were just 4 of 17 on third downs. How do you see this side of the ball playing out with Tennessee's offense that appears still limited with playmakers against the Kentucky defense that hasn't exactly performed at high levels that we expected, but does have some big bodies that could match up with Tennessee's offensive line?
I think you need to get back to being a run-first team. And I know Georgia choked that part of the Vols offense out last week, but this is a big tick down in my mind. Kentucky's D-line isn't overly dominant right now. Certainly, they've been good. They've been decent, but they're 41st in line yards, 41st in early down EPA allowed per rush. I think it's key that Tennessee gets Ty Chandler and Eric Gray going again. Build back some of that confidence. I typically hate early down runs because of their predictability, but even with the Georgia game accounted for, the Vols offense is 11th in the country in early down EPA per rush. I think you want to rely on the big guys up front. It's the strength of Tennessee's offense. And, you know, while it's not needed, sometimes I feel like offensive coordinators need to see the ground game going to then call play action passes. Like, we know it's not. Play action doesn't need the ground game to be rolling to use it and be effective and efficient. But mentally, you know, you can kind of tell play callers think using play action more if the ground game is humming a little bit. So my point to this is, if Tennessee is able to run, you might see Jim Chaney get Jared Garantano throwing with play action, and he's been significantly better throwing with that play action element. If you look at JG's passer rating right now, it increases 40 points. His yards per pass attempt is up over 5 yards more with play action. So he's just a better quarterback. When you get his legs rolling out a little bit, when you get him using that play action element. So I think it's important just mentally getting the ground game going. So Chaney chooses to use some play action. I think this is also pretty important, Todd, to get that ground game going because, you know, your defense was on the field last week for an eternity. You can't have that be the case again this week. So I think the Vols offense can help by getting the ground game going, have Jared Garantano throw with play action, and then your defense might not be on the field again this week for an absolute eternity.
Well, that definitely becomes the key because, as you mentioned, if they're on the field a lot early, it's going to try and wear them down as the game goes on, especially with a low total that suggests that this will be a physical game and the first team to 24 could get out of Neyland with a victory. Have you seen anything, Payne, on this particular game, side or total? I know when the total initially opened, we were talking about a 49 in some distant places. That number has since settled below, you know, a couple of keys below 47.
It's funny we have to phrase things that way in the current landscape, but you are you are spot on. So I have seen the group hammer this under at 49. They even dabbled at 48.5 and 48. And then you had some of the tailors, so to speak, take the secondary number, and that's why you're looking at 46.5. So under appears to be extremely real. In terms of the side, my gut is we're going to eventually see Kentucky money, as crazy as that might sound to some, in terms of how they've looked, especially offensively. But this is probably as good as a spot or situation as you will have. And I think when you're looking at Kentucky, it was a team that professional bettors were extremely high on coming into the season. They deserved better in the Auburn game. Despite a lackluster performance offensively last week, still won by 3 scores, had a 14-point lead at home over Ole Miss, an Ole Miss team that just took Alabama to the brink. So I think in terms of perception and value, professional bettors are going to see that on Kentucky, where the rest of the world right now is looking at Kentucky at 1-2 and, you know, not very good. I think professional bettors really, really like the Wildcats in general, so wouldn't be shocked to see them take some money this week.
Yeah, woulda, coulda, shoulda is all fine and good, but it is pretty interesting that if you think a couple plays had gone differently, this Kentucky team could be 3-0.
Yeah, what's the play against Ole Miss? The running back there throws up like the peace sign and then gets hawked down from behind and then fumbles at the one.
You love to see Tyreek Hill calling these guys out. I mean, if you're going to throw up the deuces, you better make sure you got 10 yards of separation and you get your ass into the end zone instead of Cadillacing like you have a piano on your back getting hawked down inside the 10-yard line.
So they've had some unfortunate luck around the gold line this season through 3 games Kentucky has.
I mean, that's essentially the gambling equivalent of giving yourself a win and patting yourself on the back at the end of the third quarter because you have a 2-touchdown lead going into the fourth. We know how often that works out well for folks in our profession that elect to do that, whether you're superstitious or not.
Absolutely.
So, should be a good game early on Saturday to kind of see how that second tier in the SEC East will play out, as I know both these teams, you know, had aspirations coming into the year of knocking Florida and Georgia from their perch if they're going to be able to do so. It'll start with a win at Neyland Stadium for one of these two familiar combatants. And last but not least on the docket, Payne, because admittedly so, we struggled mightily to try and find a fourth game to break down, and we toyed with the idea of Arkansas, Miss. We messed around with Texas A&M, Mississippi State. But we don't want to be an SEC-only podcast around these parts, and after the three biggest games in that conference, we had to do a little dumpster diving. And Payne, right now, what better location to go to do dumpster diving than your beloved Tallahassee to talk about your Florida State Seminoles, who find themselves nearly 2 touchdown underdogs at FanDuel as they'll welcome in North Carolina and Mac Brown's Tar Heels. Total in this game at FanDuel sits at 64, and North Carolina found their offensive mojo last week in a shootout against Virginia Tech.
Wouldn't surprise me if they located it once again this week, because when you look at UNC's offense, they are basically an RPO offense. And this is a really bad matchup for Florida State's defense because they don't have disciplined linebackers that can cover well. So, you know, when you look at Adam Fuller And just about every defensive coach FSU has had the last few seasons, when they stick those linebackers and man, they get roasted. We saw in the Miami game when Adam Fuller decided to go more zone in his three rush drop eight scheme. The communication is horrific, and RPO offenses absolutely kill zone defenses. So if Fuller decides to play zone, it's not going to work. If he plays man, I don't think he has the talent. The other issue is if you can't stop the run, the R part of RPO, it's going to be a real long day. And you actually had a defensive player from Virginia Tech last week say after the UNC game, establishing the run with the RPO hurt us. We could never get in rhythm defensively. Once the run game started, they had us. They had us. So when you look at FSU's defense, they can't stop the run. The strength on paper coming into the season was the interior line of FSU. But you're looking right now, Marvin Wilson is a shell of himself. No clue why he decided to return if he wasn't going to be in shape. And he is extremely out of shape. He has cost himself millions and millions of dollars. I think if the draft happened right now, you are praying, if you're Marvin Wilson, to be drafted at the back half of day two. It's been ugly. He has been horrific. Corey Durden is still recovering from offseason surgery. Robert Cooper is playing through an injury. The two ends, Kando and Robinson, look great getting off the bus. Neither can set the edge. Those four guys last season had over 31 plays made behind the line of scrimmage. This year, they've combined for 2.5. So if you just go back to last week, and I get Notre Dame's offensive line is one of the best in the country. They're going to have multiple pros. But FSU's defense ranked dead last nationally in rushing success rate allowed at 64%. FSU allowed 4.4 yards before contact. So they were just getting blown off the ball, which has been the case all season. 68th in adjusted line yards out of 76 teams. I would expect UNC is able to run the ball here. I would think they're going to be able to pass off the RPO. And we talk about it all the time, how, you know, early down runs are not the most efficient way to attack offensively. Well, Florida State's defense, fourth worst in the country in terms of EPA per rush allowed on early downs. Bad, bad matchup here against Phil Longo's offense. The only saving grace, the only positive that you could say,
that they only have to play 60 minutes.
That, but if you're looking at Phil Longo's offense, the one thing we talked about last week in the breakdown against Virginia Tech is he does like to hunt the deep ball. He likes to take the big shot. We saw that get on track a little bit against Vautech, despite being down, you know, two starting corners still. FSU's defense is in the top 10 defending the explosive pass. That's it. But this is just a really bad matchup. A lot of people have figured that out this week. It's why the total's gone from 61 to 64, along with FSU having a little bit of an identity now offensively.
Are you surprised that this number opened as low as it did? Eight, more or less, the consensus before it ballooned out closer to two touchdowns?
It's just a really bad matchup. It really is. And I think that's partly what we've seen. Once the Florida State guys kind of got the ball rolling that they're going to get out there and lay the price with North Carolina, it kind of perked up some ears of other respected guys. Now, if this gets to 14, I don't know what's going to happen at 14. Maybe you have some buyback there if you laid below the 10. This is just a really poor matchup. It really is. And, you know, if you look last week, I think from a program direction, Florida State did pretty well. No one's going to look at that final score of 42-26 and be like, they got crushed here. They actually could have threw in a backdoor touchdown to make it appear a little bit closer. And so, you know, you're hoping offensively that Florida State can keep this within distance. If you're going to cover this number in terms of backing Florida State, you're probably going to need some points to be scored here, which again lends itself to the over a little bit. The only way this doesn't go over the total is if you're seeing North Carolina constantly run it. And we know Florida State, with their current situation offensively, is more of a run-first team, although they were able to hit some explosives. Tamari and Terry, that was a pay game. And he showed up from the beginning of the game to the final whistle. And 9 targets for 9 catches. Big game for Tamari and Terry. Realized it was his money game. Everyone's going to be watching it. That's the game, you know, every scout's going to go to. And he put a good game on film. Hopefully you get the same play from him offensively here in this game as well. But offensively, I think we've seen at least the Seminoles with Mike Norvell kind of change their offensive system and gear it towards Jordan Travis. And they've been pretty successful there.
I was going to say, do you like what you've seen out of Travis so far? I mean, I know he's carried the ball 30 times in the last two games for 144 yards and looked like a somewhat competent passing threat, 13 to 24 against the Irish and 12 of 17 in his debut against Jacksonville State.
The key is FSU has to stay ahead of the down and distance. It's that simple. Jordan Travis is the best option the Seminoles have at quarterback right now. And he's a ridiculous runner. And having him start helps FSU's offensive line because it creates that extra man advantage in the box. But if you're asking Travis to consistently read defenses and deliver the ball accurately in these known passing situations on third down, that's not Jordan Travis's game. Sure, like Travis can throw accurately and hit the deep ball off of play action on early downs in these favorable situations and down and distances. But dropping back to pass the pocket quarterback on third down is going to be a challenge for him. And it's really why, whether it was Louisville, whether it was the last staff at Florida State or the current one, everyone's kind of been reluctant to hand him the keys to the car. Last week, we saw FSU had a 14% success rate on third down. When you look around the country, FSU's average distance to go on third down is 7.7 yards, so not this horrific number. But what is pretty bad is FSU's 76th, dead last in the country in EPA per pass on third downs. And again, EPA is kind of this blend of success rate and explosiveness together, merged, married together. So Florida State's been horrific because Jordan Travis in these known passing situations isn't that caliber of passer. So it's vital that FSU is good running the ball on early downs, you know, make third down manageable. You know, UNC's defense right now, middle of the pack in early down defense. So if FSU can kind of establish the ground game on early downs, live in that, you know, third and four, third and three area, or bypass third down altogether, they're probably going to have a shot to move the chains, score some points. And most importantly, if you can move the chains and establish the ground game, you're going to keep North Carolina's RPO offense on the sidelines a little bit more. And that's probably the only shot you have of stopping them.
Should be interesting. North Carolina, a team that a lot of people thought was overpriced and overhyped coming into the season. We saw the market more or less bottom out last week against Virginia Tech, where they were bet from a 5.5-point favorite down to 3 before you saw some late money coming on the Tar Heels. And for the first time in 3 games, their offense looked to be that explosive unit we thought we were going to see with Sam Howell leading the charge. We'll see if they can handle Prosperity and put up a crooked number against the Florida State Seminoles this weekend. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. And most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. We encourage all of you out there to go ahead, download the FanDuel Sportsbook app. You can check lines from absolutely anywhere. And for those folks in states where you have legalized sports betting available, new FanDuel Sportsbook customers can enjoy a boatload of risk-free bet options and plenty of bet boosts to make your weekends that much more enjoyable and, most importantly, profitable during the course of the fall. Payne, before we close up shop, though, we do have one final order of business to transact, and it's figuring out where we're going to invest our hard-earned capital this weekend.
Big matchup this weekend, Todd. Cincinnati and Tulsa.
Oh, I thought you were going to make a pick on Alabama-Georgia. I thought our listeners were going to have a chance to be excited.
I see what you did there. You ramped them up. You gave them some high expectations, and then I delivered Tulsa.
Stringing together singles, baby. That's how we work around here.
Yeah, let's go with rotation number 148. Let's go with Tulsa plus the points. It's 3 right now, widely available. Ideally, 3.5 is certainly important in this game, with the total at 43.5. Don't encourage this if it's normal juice, but the favorite in Cincinnati is juiced a little bit. So if you can get to Tulsa plus 3.5 minus 15, it is worth that half with the total at 43.5. If not, taking 3, that's what we're going to grade it at. We're going to grade it at plus 3. But if you can get to 3.5 minus 15 with 43.5, that half is worth that price. But
yep, and one thing I'm going to say, and I know our partners at FanDuel won't be thrilled with us since they're sitting at that game with Cincinnati a 2.5-point favorite. We got to encourage our listeners to go out there and get the best of the number. So shop around, although all of your other bets for the weekend, regardless of what the numbers are, should be made, of course, at FanDuel.
There you go. Got anything else?
No, I think this is an interesting game because you look at Tulsa, and there's no doubt that this team could realistically be 2-0 and have two of the best wins of any team in the country right now. They came up a bit short against Oklahoma State when they lost the season opener 16-7. I know a total that you're still kicking yourself about nearly a month later. They followed up with a nice effort against UCF 2 weeks ago, a 34-26 win, winning outright as nearly three touchdown underdogs. But the one thing we've seen from the Golden Hurricane so far this season is that they're extremely stout on the defensive line. I mean, they held both UCF and Oklahoma State to less than 4 yards per carry. We know that Cincinnati wants to employ that level of physicality. It's kind of been the hallmark, the trademark of what Luke Fickell has done, instilling that level of toughness. And when you look at this Cincinnati Bearcats team, I think you and I both believe that they've lost a little bit of that big play potential on the ground with Mike Warren going to the next level, and they're still trying to figure things out. You look at the quarterback position. We know what Desmond Ridder is. This will be his biggest test. This isn't Austin Peay. This isn't Army. This isn't South Florida. So let's hope with a little bit of home crowd there, a couple of points in our back pocket, we get an early turnover in a game that I think both these teams could be hard-pressed to get to 20. You mentioned it. The idea of getting a field goal, if you're able to grab 3.5, putting that in your back pocket is extremely invaluable.
Yeah, absolutely, without question. And just kind of looking at some of the early down rushing metrics, you mentioned the departure of Warren. Cincinnati has not been very good on early down runs, 72nd in the country in rushing EPA on early downs. And there's about to be 19-mile-per-hour winds here in this game, partly why we've seen this total crash down a little bit. Tulsa, the more efficient early down ground team here, which I think is kind of a tiny built-in advantage for the Tulsa Golden Hurricane. Are they still the Golden Hurricane, Todd?
I think they're still the Golden Hurricane. I don't think anybody has been morally offended by that nickname.
Perfect. Let's get out of Dodge now.
So, yeah, let's do it. Anything else you want to share? I mean, I know you're a huge college football fan that'll be glued to his TV set watching Texas State and South Alabama on Saturday. You know, I just wasn't sure if there were any games that you wanted to hit on before we let bygones be bygones, regroup, and get to talk about the National Football League same time tomorrow.
No, that's everything.
All right. For Payne Insider, you can follow Payne on Twitter, of course, at Payne Insider. Yeah, that's right. You think I should know it at this point. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. Most importantly, as we say all the time, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And come Saturday, early afternoon, after you've watched a rock fight ensue with a Tulsa Golden Hurricane ticket in hand, we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.